نستعين ونستغفره ونعوذ بالله من شرور أنفسنا ومن سيئات أعمالنا، من يهده الله فلا مضل له ومن يضلل فلا هادي له، وأشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له وأشهد أن محمدا عبده ورسوله. All praise is due to Allah, and as such we should praise Him. We should seek His help and seek His forgiveness. And we should also seek refuge in Allah from the evil which is within ourselves and the evil which results from our deeds. For whomsoever Allah has guided, none can misguide. And whomsoever Allah has allowed to go astray, none can guide. And I bear witness that there is no God worthy of worship but Allah, who is alone without partner, and that Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wasallam is the last messenger of Allah. This evening's presentation is Islamic culture versus Western culture. This topic is of course of specific significance to us in the West, as a minority community here in Bahamas in the West, and it is of significance to Muslims internationally to understand what constitutes Western culture and what, if there is an Islamic culture, should Muslims adopt as an alternative to what is being presented through the media as the world culture. Now, in order to understand the issues of Islamic culture and Western culture, it's first necessary to understand what is culture. And from an anthropological point of view, it is viewed as the man-made part of the human environment. A culture is the way of life of a specific group. Now the word culture comes from the Latin word cultura, which is a derivative of the verb colere, meaning tending or cultivation. It was really used initially to refer to the tending of animals, animal husbandry. This is what the original use of the word was. But by the 16th century, in 1510, the Oxford Dictionary of the English Language had modified that meaning and began to define it as training of the mind or manners. Now, though all students of human society agree upon the indispensable importance of the concept of culture, no single definition has yet won universal acceptance in the various schools of anthropology. But basically the idea of culture arises from the observation that human beings do and of what human beings do and what they refrain from doing, that it is in part a consequence of being brought up in one group as opposed to another. And it has been observed that people have both a social heredity as well as a biological heredity. Now, what can we then say using this general understanding of what is culture, that is the body of knowledge and practices which are taught within the family, within the system of education of the society, both formally and informally, wherein people learn to behave in particular ways that become conventional and fixed by tradition. In terms of Western culture, we can say basically the origin of Western culture is pagan. It is of pagan origin. It is referred to as Greco-Roman thought, or the Greco-Roman civilization, meaning its origins are in Greece and Rome. And anybody reading any books of history, Greece, Greek and Roman history, quickly realizes that these were pagan societies. founded on idolatry. And the other component of Western culture can be found in Northern Europe, what may be called Scandinavia. They also made a major contribution. Peoples, the Germanic peoples and others, you know, contributed to what we now know as Western culture. This is very evident to us in certain basic things, like even the days of the week, how we name the days of the week. Saturday is from Saturn's day. Saturn, the god of agriculture of the Romans. Right? It's very basic. You know? Monday or Sunday, the day for the worship of the sun god. Monday, the day for the worship of the moon god. Thursday is from the Scandinavian god Thor. It was originally Thor's day, the god of thunder. And Wednesday was from Woden's day, another of the Scandinavian gods. So you can see that even the very names of the days of the week, this is right out of pagan culture, and this is what we have inherited in the West. And even Christ's teachings, Jesus Christ, who originally promoted a non-pagan system of religion, which we understand to be Islam fundamentally, that is the worship of God, the Creator, and not the worship of His creation. By the time that the Greeks and the Romans got a hold of it, it again became paganized. And people returned back to worship of human beings, you know, statues, etc., etc. All we have to do is look around us at the symbols of Christmas. What does Christmas represent? You know, the 25th of December comes straight out of Roman practice, the celebration known as the Saturnalia, again, to the giving thanks to the god of agriculture, Saturn, you know, which took place at the same time, you know, the winter equinox, right? And similarly, the tree, because actually in the Saturnalia, part of the celebration was they would give gifts. This was part of the thing. They would give dolls and things like this to the children. This was part of their celebrations. And the tree, which is now the standard symbol of Christmas, we know that came from the Scandinavians, who believed the evergreen for them was a symbol of God. When they looked at all the trees, when winter came, all the trees, they turned brown, the leaves fell off, and they appeared to die. But the evergreen tree remained green. And this concept of eternal life, you know, is there it is in the tree. So the tree became a symbol of their God. And as they were Christianized, they brought this in along with them, and it became a standard symbol for Christianity. Now, in spite of that origin, with the Roman Church gaining control over most of West Roman, both Eastern Roman and Western Roman, another set of values were brought in, you know. Some of them, we could say, are Mosaic, because they did have the Old Testament along with them. So some aspects of Jewish culture, so it became Judeo-Christian culture, you know, is being infused. And of course, the origin of that is from divine revelation, in spite of certain distortions. So there was another component which came in. However, by the 15th, 16th century, due to the struggle between the church and the scientists, the free thinkers, etc., you had a split. They actually began with the Protestant movement of Martin Luther. You know, he began that initial split from the control of the church in the thought patterns for the whole, you know, of that region. And they rejected many of the practices. But from that came the scientists who now started to question a number of other areas, and there's a rise in atheistic thought. In fact, out of that period, you know, centuries later, came the next expression, which is really, we could call it a return to the pagan roots, wherein a scientific basis was provided for it by the Darwinian theory. Back to the pagan roots again. Pagan roots being that in ancient Greece, it was believed that the world was eternal. There are a number of ancient Greek philosophers who held this. It's an ancient idea that the world is eternal. Right? You don't need to go to the issue of God. You know, this is always there. No gods to create. So basically, Darwinism is providing again that foundation to go back to the concept of the world being eternal, matter being eternal. Human beings are a natural product of the development of nature, the survival of the fittest, and you know, accidental creation by nature. Mother Nature, you know, becomes the big word which is always used. Mother Nature. When you think about it, go back to pagan Romans and the Greeks, Mother Nature is a symbol, is one of their gods, you know, it's a symbol. Mother Nature, you hear them talking about, you know, why a plant, you know, you look at, say, the fly catcher. You have a plant which will catch flies. It's got teeth on it, right? Venus fly trap. And they'll talk about how Mother Nature evolved this fly, you know, or how this plant developed this ability, you know, it evolved to this. When you listen to the actual statements and expressions of how these came about, you really can see, you know, the root paganism that lies in it. Out of that came the culture, the 20th century culture now, of secularism, the complete overthrow of the church. Secularism being a system of beliefs which rejects all form of religious faith and worship. The view that public education and other matters of civil policy should be conducted without the introduction of the religious element. This is secularism. And the basis of that, of this approach, they called humanism. You know, away from religion, now we go to humanism. Humanism being a system of, or mode of thought or action in which humans and secular interests predominate. I mean, how do we determine what we should do in the society? It is based on what is beneficial. What you conceive to be beneficial, this is what is good. What you don't conceive to be beneficial, this is what is not good. You know, so you decide on the way things should be according to human interest. There's no outside individual or power or source which will define for you what is right and what is wrong. And the other major symbol of Western culture is democracy. Democracy, again, from Greek origin, originally meaning the rule of the people. Right? It evolved in Greece, especially in Athens. And there, the people used to gather and vote and decide, you know, how society would function. They didn't used to have major structures of parliament and all this kind of thing because the society was not big. So they would have assemblies and everybody had a right to a vote. Ideas were put forward and they just made decisions. However, slaves and women were excluded. They had no vote. And the slaves and women made up something close to 70% of the population. So this so-called democracy, you know, was a decision made by a minority of the inhabitants as to the way the society would function. And, you know, as they say, as is said in Collier's Encyclopedia, Western democracy reaches beyond the confines of government and affects all phases of human relations. I tell you that, by the way. It's a way of life. Democracy as a way of life is based on several basic principles. Actually, three basic principles. The first principle is rational empiricism. Right? What is rational empiricism? Fundamentally, consisting of a confidence in human reason and experience. This is it. Human reason, we have the ability, the intelligence, and the experience to determine what is in fact best for us. It holds that reason is applicable not only to the understanding and mastery of nature, but also to the understanding and conduct of social problems. Man can find the solutions from his own brain. He can do it. The second basic principle is called discussion and consent. Since no one in the democratic view possesses absolute truth, that's what they say, they deny all absolute truth. They'll tell you, as you're taught in school, as you're growing up, truth is relative. You know, one man's meat
It's another man's poison. These are all, you know, the reminders of, so you don't get this idea that there is some absolute truth. No. So, since no one has absolute truth, all sides to an argument must be given free expression. No truth is so certain that it may not be challenged. This is fundamental principles of democracy. Furthermore, the third principle is that of equality. And from the rationalist humanist viewpoint, all human beings share, over and above differences of class, race, sex, nationality, and religion, one common trait: the ability to reason. So the issues of reason, the human mind and its abilities, this is given, elevated to a status now of God. It becomes the God of this century. Human beings have given the decisions of the human intellect reign and right over all else. Practically speaking, what this comes down to is that all of the various cultural practices in the society will be affected by these concepts. Darwinism will be affecting it, secularism, humanism, democracy, all of these principles will be affecting the various cultural norms of the society. So as Muslims, we have to realize that. We cannot just absorb, you know, the society, the practice of the society, and accept it. We have to look to see, is there in fact an Islamic culture that we should be following? Now, what we find in the mass of the Muslim world today is cultural Islam. That is, traditionalism. We're looking for Islamic culture. But what we find in general is cultural Islam. This traditionalism is based on the principle of blind following of cultural norms. It's the foundation of it. The blind following of cultural norms. What has been inherited. And you find in the Quran that when Prophet Muhammad, may God's peace and blessing be upon him, invited people back to the worship of one God, to give up their false gods, etc., their response was, we must hold on to those cultural norms. Allah says in the Quran, وَإِذَا قِيلَ لَهُمْ تَعَالَوْا إِلَى مَا أَنزَلَ اللَّهُ وَإِلَى الرَّسُولِ. If you say to them, come to what Allah has revealed and to His Messenger, قَالُوا حَسْبُنَا مَا وَجَدْنَا عَلَيْهِ أَبَاءَنَا. It is sufficient for us what we found our foreparents doing. Allah goes on to question them, أَوَلَوْ كَانَ آبَاؤُهُمْ لَا يَعْلَمُونَ شَيْئًا وَلَا يَهْتَدُونَ. Even though their foreparents didn't know anything and were not rightly guided. But this is the standard response of the cultural Muslim today. When the truth, because Islam is based on the Quran and the Sunnah, when the Quran and the Sunnah is presented to them, their response is, if it was good enough, what we were doing was good enough for our parents and our foreparents, it's good enough for us. Right? So, what comes out of that is the madhab fanaticism, you know, madhabism, where people now attribute their cultural practices to a school of Islamic law, the madhab. The madhab takes on a cultural role. Though the madhab, or the school of Islamic law, represented the attempts of early scholars to apply the Quran and Sunnah, the Sharia, in daily life, it took on a rigidity, a fixed set of practices that now became cultural norms. So you may find people doing things and the first thing they will say, that's according to my madhab. Though if you actually go into their school of law, you may find it's not there at all. It may not be there at all. But that's what the people do, and that was their school of Islamic law, so they tend to attribute everything back to the school. Also what you find, you know, which is as a result of this, is that, you know, bid'ah, or extensive innovation in religious practices, is the norm in those societies. That people are involved in all kinds of practices which contradict basic Islamic principles. Whether it's building tombs over graves, or, you know, performing religious rites around graves,
or you know, from the beginning to the lowest walks of life to the uppermost walks of life, all the areas you find inundated, you know, mixed up with these various innovations. And what also is closely linked with this is the so-called Islamic mysticism or Sufism, which provides a spiritual culture, this other culture, the spiritual support for this cultural Islam, wherein people are offered shortcuts to God, you know, as the Pope in the medieval days, you know, used to offer medieval and the Middle Ages, they used to offer people tickets to paradise, actual certificates which said that the possessor of this certificate has the right to go to paradise, and if you paid your money, your name was put on the certificate and it was signed by the Pope. This is known as the indulgences. You just open an encyclopedia, read about the indulgences. You know, this was practiced for a number of years, hundreds of years, in the Christian Catholic Church. Just as they had that in the past, you have people in the cultural Islamic environment promoting similar free trips to paradise. You have, for example, the most popular individual today in that promoting this amongst, especially in the West, is an individual by the name of Sheikh Nazim Al-Haqqani. Just had a big conference out in California. A lot of people were invited there. Los Angeles, major world conference, right? And this individual, when you read his writings, he tells his followers that whoever has accepted him as their sheikh, they become his murid, one who has given up his will to the sheikh, meaning whatever the sheikh tells him to do, he does. Whoever accepts him as their sheikh, he says, that when the time to die comes, that the angel of death will not take their soul. He will be there to take their soul and pass it on to the next life. And when the angels Munkar and Nakir come to question them in the grave, who is your Lord? Man Rabbuk? What was your religion? Ma Dinuk? Who was your Prophet? Ma Nabiyuk? He will be there to answer the questions for you. And on the Day of Judgment, when you stand before God and God questions you, He will also be there beside you to answer your question. So this is a shortcut to paradise being offered, which of course is false. It's false. This individual is deluding people and stealing their souls. Stealing their souls. Now, the question that we end up with is, having a brief overview of cultural Islam, what constitutes the basis of Western culture, the question arises, is there an Islamic culture? Is there such a thing as what may be called an Islamic culture? Now, in the beginning we said that the definition, or a definition, of culture was the way of life of a specific group. The way of life of a specific group. And we know in Islam we are obliged to follow the way of the Prophet, may God's peace and blessing be upon him, the Sunnah, right? Which means the way of life. His way of life. And Allah said regarding it, لَقَدْ كَانَ لَكُمْ فِي رَسُولِ اللَّهِ أُسْوَةً حَسَنًا. There is in the Messenger of Allah the best of examples. So the way of life which he brought, which he taught, as with the prophets before him, all of the prophets taught a way of life. A way of life based on divine revelation. That way of life is the foundation of the Islamic culture. Within that culture, of course, we know that the foundational principles is revelation. Right? The Islamic foundation is distinct and different from the democratic view. The foundation is revelation, meaning that it is not left up to the individuals to determine rationally, you know, what it should be the norms for society as well as government. Those norms are set by God. Because God created society, God knows human strengths and weaknesses and can set for us laws which are not class-based or, you know, with any kind of interest. You know, whether people call it, you know, sex-based, sexist, you know, where males may tend to want to put laws favoring the males over the females, things like this. No. Allah, beyond all that, because He created male and female, then the laws that He has established are for mankind in general. And in fact, we believe that there are absolute truths. There are absolute truths. Those which have been defined by Allah and His Messenger. So, when we come to the obvious expressions of culture, we then have to analyze them in terms of to what degree the Western philosophy plays a role, to what degree does Muslim culture or cultural Muslim practices play a role, and to what degree is there in fact Islamic culture here? I mean, what is the Islamic cultural aspects of this particular practice? For example, we'll take one of the most obvious things in society, dress. Dress, the way we dress. Okay? In terms of dress, we believe that this is something, a part of human nature. This is something began by Adam. Right? It is part of heredited, you know, a human culture. There's aspects which are learned. This is hereditary. The learning part is more the details in terms of how it should be and style, etc., etc. This is where the individual cultures come into play. But that this is fundamentally a part and parcel of human nature. Now, from the Western point of view, Western culture, which has adopted the Darwinian approach, that human beings are in fact, you know, devolved from or evolved from apes, or a common ancestor with the apes, then the question of dress becomes one of, you know, of attitude now. This is, they're looking at the, what is the purpose of this dress? When we look at a dog walking around, we don't find the dog trying to cover himself, to hide himself. Yeah? So I said that this idea of human beings want to hide their privates, you know, that this is something which has been put on them by the society. It's a kind of a phobia, some kind of, you know, quirk, psychological error that has taken part in their development. So they promote back to nature. You know, let us be natural. So we have the nudist beaches, we have the nudist camps, you know, where in Germany, places like this, they have huge, you know, huge areas which are like parks, where everybody in there is stark naked. I mean, from the guy in the gate collecting your tickets all the way, people selling ice cream cones, everybody, man, woman, children, everybody, stark naked. This is a culture. This is a view, and it finds its expression in a number of different ways. I know in Canada, in Toronto, where I grew up, students from junior high, I went to junior high and high school, all male students had to swim naked. This is the law. The only way you could get out of that is if you had a doctor's excuse. I mean, you had some kind of disease, you know, it was embarrassing for you, you had to cover it up, something else. Otherwise, you had to go swimming stark naked. And you know, so this is part of that same philosophy that, you know, this idea of being shy is, you know, it's unnatural. We've got to go back to nature. We don't see the animals acting in this way. So since we are basically animals, we shouldn't have these feelings. So You then have your communal showers. You know, after you play football or play whatever, cricket, you go in. Instead of having individual showers, you have a just have a big room with, you know, shower faucets and everybody standing there naked, clean, washing themselves. You know? This is part of the whole, this is a philosophy. This is a culture. It's the culture, the secularist culture. So, when we look at the purposes of dress, right, we can say that from an Islamic point of view, the first purpose of dress is to cover the private parts. First purpose is to cover the private parts. The second purpose is protecting oneself from the elements. From the elements, whether from the sun or from wind, the cold or the winter, whatever, you know. It's part of it. And the third purpose is beauty. You know, you beautify it. And Allah tells us in the Quran that we should take our most beautiful garments when we go to the masjid and so on. Okay? Beautification. That's part of our dress, is part of beautification. Now, this is the order Islam looks at it first. First and foremost, cover the private. Second, protection from the elements. Third, beauty. Now, in the Western concept, the secularist concept, Darwinian product, first is beauty. That's number one. Beauty is most important. This is why you will find a woman wearing a hyper mini skirt, you know, in the dead of winter in New York City, you know, 10, 15 degrees below zero, she's wearing a hyper mini skirt. Obviously, her dress is not to protect her from the elements. You know, her private parts are being exposed. So number one is beauty. They reverse the whole, you know, their whole look. Because, basically, we're animals. You know? And how do animals function? The animal, you know, the female, she likes to spread her tail feathers, you know, to attract the male. So this is the most important function. Second is to protect from elements. You know, so they do have something, maybe, you know, what do you call them, stockings like underneath, whatever, you know. And then third is covering the private. And third, I mean, is a minor. I mean, it's only, and we can see this whole, even the third aspect of covering the private, this is slowly disappearing. You know, centuries ago, yes, it was there. Right in. But as time has evolved, time has passed, then the whole issue of covering the private is out. What is most important now is showing the private. Covered, but uncovered. Right? This is the whole thrust of dress from the Western cultural viewpoint. Now, from a cultural Islamic viewpoint, we have different types of dress. In Malaysia, they like to wear the sarong. In Pakistan and India, they wear the shalwar kameez. You know, many of the Arab and Afro-Arab cultures, they wear the thob, long garments. And a variety of other names for other types of garments that are worn, and different styles, etc. And these, ultimately, are cultural expressions. Now, Islam doesn't deny the cultural expressions as long as they don't conflict with the principles of Islamic dress. I mean, what constitutes Islamic culture and dress represents the principles of dress. That for the male, the dress should cover at least between the navel and the knee. And it should be above the ankle. It should not be certain colors like bright orange, which is associated with orange red, associated with Buddhists. The Buddhist monks wear this. Also, it shouldn't be silk. And the ornamentation shouldn't be gold. These are principles of Islamic dress, which represent the dress which comes out of that, we can say, represents a product of Islamic culture. So where there were cultures existing in those societies before the coming of Islam, whatever were the cultural norms had to be modified to match the Islamic principles. Similarly, in the female dress, that the woman is required to cover everything except for her face and hands. And in the same way that when we say covered, it should be covered and not covered yet uncovered, meaning that a woman wearing, you know, aerobic tights would not be considered covered, though her physically speaking her whole body is covered with material, but it is not covered. It's covered yet uncovered. And in the same way, for males wearing, you know, pants which accentuate the private parts, form them, show them, this is not acceptable, not considered covering. So here we can identify within the dress codes what could be defined as Islamic culture with regard to dress. Another common issue in culture is that of mixing, you know, mixed education. This is where it started from. Mixed education. We're going to educate boys and girls together. In the past, in Western culture, they did separate between boys and girls. But with the permissiveness and the secularist approach to education, these practices, these church schools which used to separate, where did the church school separation come from? It came from Judaic practices. In Judaism, separation of the men and the women, this was based on revelation. Moving away from the church, then these values no longer important. The church, everybody came together in the church, also in school, everybody came together. So the mixing began in the educational milieu, and from there it went to the society as a whole. That, you know, the mixing of men and women in workplaces and in all the different walks of life became the norm. Of course, what resulted from that is, especially in modern times, is the harassment of women. So you find women writing all these books about harassment of women on the job, you know, in America and England, which are, you know, supposed to be the most progressive of these societies. The women are harassed. Every year we read of incidents in the army, in the navy, the tailhook incident, and all this kind of stuff. Women being harassed. They're doctors, they're lawyers, they're professors, they're all these fields, but yet, once they're mixed with the men, they're being harassed. So, out of this culture of mixing, is harm coming to the female. In fact, way back in 1991 in America, the reported number of rapes had crossed the 100,000 mark. And they estimate that this is only 1/7 to 1/10 of the actual numbers. Yeah, this is what they estimate. No, because most women will not report it. You know, for the embarrassment and everything else, they don't. So they, you know, the estimate is something 7 to 10 times that number. And this is in the most permissive of the societies. Yet, this is happening. Why? Because of that intermingling, one, two, also the dress codes, where the female has been, you know, unclothed in the society. She is used to promote the products that are being sold, and with that mixing, that continuous contact under those circumstances, with that frame of mind, then the end result is the harassment, serious harassment of women. Because we know that those 100,000 cases of rape, there are not too many among them of women raping men. Right? In some cases, I suppose, but I mean, when they talk about this rape, automatically people focus on men raping women, because that's the general way it happens, right? So, the harm which comes out of the mixing is so obvious. In education, we find even for places like New York, where some of the black educators in New York are trying to set up all girls schools, all boys schools. Going back to this, there's a big struggle in the Department of Education there, that this is, you know, it is sexism and this type of thing. No, we should be integrating these schools. Why are you going backwards? But the educators have found that boys and girls studying together don't help each other. It harms. It is harmful. That it is more effective. Kids learn better when they're with their own sex, you know, in groupings for education. So they themselves, you know, are going back to the methodology which was taught by divine revelation. Islamic view is that of separation. Separation begins in the area of worship, in our place of worship. We're not mixing together. The women are separate from the men. To all walks of life within the home, the tradition, Islamic tradition, which evolves from that, is that normally where there are people, you know, outside of the home, then the women eat together and the men eat together. You know, the idea of, you know, all the men sitting around at a table with all the women, this is not, I mean, though people might look at it as being Arab culture to separate, no. It is in keeping with the Islamic culture. Because the harm of mixing in prayer, the harm of mixing in work circumstances, is also there in the mixing even in the areas of meals. And this is why, for example, in greetings, you know, this is a common form of greeting in Western society, shaking the hand. You know, women shake hands with men shake hands with women. But from Islamic perspective, no. Women will shake hands with women, men shake hands with men. You know, it's not permissible. It's forbidden for the protection of what may result. You know, though most people shaking hands, men and women, they may not be thinking anything, but those who know that a handshake can mean a lot more than a handshake, right? So to protect from circumstances where other, you know, meanings and understandings can be gained from it, the society is protected by prohibiting this type of interaction. When we come also in terms of celebrations, the other major cultural manifestation in the society, regular manifestation, the Western cultural celebrations we mentioned are fundamentally pagan. They're Christmas, their Easter, their, you know, the national day, the whatever days, etc. All of these various celebrations tend to be of a pagan type origin. So, as Muslims, we are not permitted to take part in these various celebrations because of the fact that they are fundamentally pagan. This is the reasons why we are not allowed to take part. Because, you know, some people may argue, for example, that if a Christian, you know, will attend, you know, Muslim celebrations, they will take part in the Eid and, you know, wish people happy Eid and this type of thing, why can't we wish them also Merry Christmas? You know, they don't believe in our Eid, we don't believe in their Christmas, you know, this is just a... But the point is that for them, because the celebration really has no solid religious, you know, basis, this is now Santa Claus, this is Christmas, it's no longer about the birth of Jesus. I mean, you hear some songs here and there, but the key is Santa Claus, the key figure of Santa Claus, this guy flying through the air, and, you know, a fairy tale, a lie which children are taught, you know. The essence of it is from the paganistic belief that God was born on the 26th of December. That's the essence of it. So for Muslims, we cannot accept that God was born. Period. You know. So, as we would say to a Christian, look, okay, if a Satan worshipper, we have Satan worshippers, if a Satan worshipper greeted you, Happy Satan's Day, would you rejoice also? And Happy Satan's Day to you too? No. Why? Because you can, though it may be his celebration, etc., you cannot relate to that. This is something totally contrary to your belief. You know, you don't celebrate Satan's works and, you know, in the society. Similarly for us, to deal with Christmas is like for us Christians to deal with Happy Satan's Day. Because we are celebrating, joining in the celebration in the birth of God. The idea that God was born, which is totally opposed to our system of belief. So it is not acceptable for us to take part in those celebrations, as well as any other celebrations which are related to their
that's what we've been taught. But it's a lie. It's not true. There is no such thing. There is only one race, and that is the human race. That is the reality. The differences in color and form and, you know, height and all these things, these differences are incidental. As we don't, you know, look, when we look at cats, they have big cats, little cats, red cats, black cats, yellow cats, you know, all these different colors of cats. We don't call any one of them something other than a cat. They're all cats, right? As human beings, it's the same thing. And in fact, God has left a message to mankind within the biological makeup of man that if you reflect, as Allah said, and if you reflect even in yourself, you'll know about God. That we cannot deny, transcend the so-called divisions of race. Because if you are in need of a blood transfusion and you are type A, your brothers, all the other Afro-Bahamian brothers are all type O, and there's one European visiting from America, or you're American or European from Europe, whatever, here, and he or she is type A, only her blood can save you. Only her blood can save your life. So if her blood can save your life, she obviously is closer to you than we are. That is the signs that God has left among us. And we only discovered it in these times, you know. But these are the times when the issues of race were being promoted as divisions among mankind to justify the exploitation of the other societies when Europe spread out, and to justify their rape of these other cultures. They justified it by these people belonging to other races, which are, according to the Darwinian evolutionary tree, lower on the ladder, closer to the monkeys, you know. They put themselves on the top, you know, down the row, you know, you find us close to the monkeys, right? So this is what was promoted as a justification for colonization and the rape of non-European cultures. So in order to further support this issues of races, and then they started to argue issues about, you know, certain races being inferior, and, you know, the big struggle that in recent times, because this has been rejected officially, there are still some scholars, quote-unquote scholars in the West, who pop up from time to time and try to make the same argument, you know, that blacks are inferior and this type of things, you know. So the issues then regarding race, for us Islamically, it has no place. An extension of aspect of race is nation, is tribe. These are all expressions of tribalism, and they have no place in Islam. This is why we cannot take part in as Muslims. We're not allowed to take part in these expressions of tribalism in the societies. Even if we're in Muslim societies and they want to do it, it's still not acceptable. We know that Prophet Muhammad, may God peace and blessings be upon him, when he came to Medina, he found the people having a number of yearly annual celebrations. And he told them that they should stop all these celebrations, that we only have two celebrations, which are religious celebrations, that of Eid al-Fitr, celebrating the breaking of the fast of Ramadan, and Eid al-Adha, celebrating commemorating Prophet Abraham's willingness to sacrifice his son, on which that day we also sacrifice animals and distribute the meat for needy, etc. We can find in another expression of culture in the area of marriage a number of Western cultural practices, like the white dress and the rice and the flowers on the cars and the tin cans, and, you know, these are Western practices which, when you track down the origins of them, generally speaking, they will be linked back to some aspects of paganism, driving away the evil spirits and these kind of things, right? Even the wearing of the wedding ring on the
finger, wearing of the wedding ring on the finger, from Catholic tradition, early Catholic tradition, when the priest would put the ring by the thumb, saying, in the name of the Father, in the name of the Son, in the name of the Holy Ghost, Amen. So that wearing of this the ring signifying marriage on his finger was a confirmation of the pagan Trinitarian concept of God. So for Muslims, we cannot accept any of these. We can't say, well, okay, to wear the ring, you know, it lets people know I'm married. But no, this is linked to a particular pagan culture. So from the Islamic perspective, in terms of marriage, there are no special wedding dresses. Where Muslims tend to be in contact with other societies, they take it. So you may find Muslims, you know, though they're wearing the hijab, you know, the woman covering themselves, they want to wear a white dress on that day, you know. But see, where is it coming from? Similarly, this is here because this is the custom here. For example, you'll find Muslims in India and Pakistan, they wear a red dress. Why? Because the Hindus marry in a red dress. So they have taken that much into their own practices, marriage practices. Also, the issue of the dowry. When you actually look up the definition of dowry, it is explained that dowry is the money given by the parents of the bride to the groom. This is what dowry is. This is the Western tradition. That is what it is. And this is also Hindu practice. Hindu practice also. Right? And Muslims, you know, who are in contact with these societies, you'll find Muslims in places like Sri Lanka, in Pakistan, in India, you know, those cultures close, they have also adopted this. So you'll find there, traditionally, for Muslim daughters to get married, their fathers have to give huge dowries to the men. But Islamic culture teaches that the dowry is given, this is unique, the dowry is given from the man to the woman, given as a symbol of the man's preparedness to maintain and look after that woman properly. So, within the context of marriage itself, as I'm saying, you know, we can find in all of the various aspects norms which have become what we would call Islamic cultural norms, and the Western or pagan cultures have their own set of traditions which Muslims are not allowed to partake of. In terms of the culture of food, the way in which people eat food, the types of food they eat, the times at which they eat the food, all of these represent, again, cultural expressions. For Muslims, there is an Islamic culture regarding food. The way in which food is eaten, there are specific instructions given by the Prophet, may God's peace and blessing be upon him, which identify how Muslims are supposed to eat. He said that the believer eats as if he has one stomach, and the disbeliever eats as if he has seven. That for the believer, he eats a third, he drinks a third, and he leaves a third for breathing. And the worst thing that a human being can fill is his stomach. So Islamic cultural norm is that the believers eat moderately, not eating till they're full, you know, which is part and parcel of the Western culture. You eat, you know, till you're full, till you're satisfied. You eat. And unfortunately, for many Muslims, when Ramadan comes, these principles are lost, thrown out the window. We fast all day long, and we're supposed to break the fast with 3 days, and then have a moderate meal. This is the test now, have we really fasted? But instead, what happens is people are setting up 3-4 courses of meal, they're eating till they're full. Eat till, you know, you sort of give a hiccup, you know, that's it. If you try to put anything more down, it's all coming up, you know. And then, of course, when you stand for the night prayers, you know, like the snake when he gets full, he more constricted, he goes to sleep. When you stand for your night prayer, you fight him to stay awake and all these, you know. This is all because of the fact that we have broken the fundamental, you know, Islamic cultural norms in eating. The eating with the right hand, you know, and not eating with the left. I mean, this is to help us. You know, in the Western culture, you go to the burger stand, you know, you got a burger in your right, you got a Coke in your left, you know, you can just stuff it in from both sides, right? You know. Whereas Islamic system, you only eat it with the right. That left, you can't be, no. You finish eating, you want to drink, you stop eating, then you take your drink, you know. So you have to break up, slow you down. These are all among the benefits, right, of the... And of course, when we look at all the ailments that people suffer, etc., I mean, the major ailments, sicknesses, etc., are from the stomach. Things connected with the stomach. You know, with eating habits. I mean, all these problems of cholesterol and all this stuff, it relates always back to eating habits. Because even if a person lived a life which was not very active, because it's a part of the problem, is that people are not so active, you know, so they, you know, that's why you have treadmills and all these other things to put activity back in our lives, right? But the fact of the matter is that if we ate moderately, even if we were inactive, the food wouldn't hurt us. But because we don't eat moderately, and we're inactive, then it hurts. So, the Islamic culture, with regards to foods, we can see, you know, the norms are clearly defined. And it is for us to identify them and to implement them. So in summary, we can say that culture being the way of life of a particular group includes both Western culture with its pagan origin, which we should be aware of, what its goals are, what its norms are, etc., as well as Muslim people's culture, which tends to be that of traditionalism, you know, blind following of traditions which have been inherited, not wanting to change these traditions, and what in fact we should be seeking, Islamic culture, which has its norms set by revelation, the Quran and the Sunnah. This is the foundation for Islamic culture. And it is essential for us in all of the various walks of life that we function within, in this society, here or in Muslim countries, we do have to keep in mind these distinctions. Because oftentimes people, when they newly come into Islam, they are unable to distinguish between the traditional culture of Muslim peoples and what in fact is Islamic culture. And in doing so, they end off in certain tangents, become very rigid, holding on to certain things which are in fact not a part of Islam at all. So the solution fundamentally really is that of education. It is essential for us to be educated in Islamic teachings, not only as the rituals of worship, what are involved in them, the goals of worship, etc., but also what constitutes Islamic culture and etiquette, the morality of Muslim society. Inshallah, I will pause here. There is much, inshallah, that we can discuss. So I'll leave the remainder to an open discussion.
Really, about the Christmas celebration and stuff like that, in relation to Islam, what if you get gifts, right, from family members, you told them not to get in, you still receive gifts, and they still let the tree up, and they get still underneath the tree, one open.
Okay, if you find yourself in a situation where you visited your parents' home and they have the tree up, they're non-Muslims, and they have gifts under the tree in your name, should you then take these gifts? No. You don't take these gifts. You tell them, if you want to give me a gift, you give me any day but this day. You know, I appreciate your intention, but for me to accept the gift on that day is taking part in Christmas celebration. The gift which is wrapped in Christmas symbols, you know, to accept such a gift is a part of, because that was, as I mentioned, this was a part of the early celebration, the Saturnalia. They gave these gifts in as part of their rituals of worship of the god Saturn.
That, you know, before Islam came to a certain city or whatever, right, that the style of clothes they had, right, that when Islam came, they had to adjust to the performance of Islam. Right, say in the society of jeans, you know, this is wrong, because, you know, I'm a person, you know, so that will be about the anchors, right, but, you know, does that mean that we change this for the dress of the Middle East, or is this okay to wear, and we just cut it?
Okay, as you said, say the norm of dress here are jeans for males, for example, wearing pants. Yeah, whatever, pants, really, talking about pants. So, Islamically speaking, you know, can we wear these pants? Well, there were cultures that Islam went to where the people did have a tradition of wearing pants. You know, in Turkey, in India, they wore pants. That is part of their culture already. But what happened is that these pants were modified. Right? Two things happened. Either they were modified, where, for example, in Turkey, you know, the crotch of the pants goes down to almost your ankle. You know, in the Libyan pants, same thing. The crotch is all the way down to your ankle. Right? You know, so it means everything is just so loose, you know, there's, you know, you're properly covered. Or, for example, in Pakistan, you know, the pants itself was also very wide. The crotch came up higher, but, you know, it was still so loose in bending and these type of things, it's not, it wasn't showing your privates. Or in India itself, where they wore pants which are more like our pants, tight pants, they wore a top which came down to the knee. So that the critical area of covering, which is between the navel and the knee, was covered. So when the man bends, you know, when he sits, etc., his private parts are not being exposed. So you can either modify it in terms of its form, and what you have to consider really, you know, a person may feel shy about doing either of these two suggestions, but the fact of the matter is that there is a fashion trend which is coming now towards big baggy pants, you know, and these same people wearing tight pants now, you know. You know, give them a couple more years, they're going to be wearing big baggy pants, you know, and that will be the norm. Wearing tight pants will be unfashionable, you know, and everybody will go along with it, you know. And the point is that for the Muslim, you know, he has his own personality. He has a standard that he follows. He's not fashion conscious. He's not a slave to fashion, as they call him, you know. Prophet Muhammad said, he's not imma'. That whenever people are this way, he's going that way. When people are going that way, he's going that way. You know, he has no mind of his own. This is part of that independent thinking. So, for the Muslim, wearing clothes actually becomes an act of worship. The wearing of clothes becomes an act of worship when he or she wears clothes in conformity with the instructions of God. So this is an act of worship now. And also when they're putting on their clothes, that they remember God. Say Bismillah. You know, when they're putting on, they put on the right side before the left side. All of this is a part of that method and the way of the Prophet. So the act of wearing clothes is something which is done consciously, and it becomes a means of reminding the person of God.
In the part about the ankles, right? You can understand that in those days that we had a trend that the rich people had more money to buy clothes, right? More clothes. So that was one of the reasons why the Prophet said that you should wear about the ankles, so the poor person who couldn't, you know, afford that extra cloth, that they wouldn't feel bad or something like that. You know, that's true.
Well,
okay, so
the issue of wearing the pants below the ankle, where our brother is suggesting that, you know, in the past this was looked at as being wearing pants below the ankle looked at as being a means of extravagance. You know, the rich. No, this is what it was. The rich in the past. Okay, you read it someplace. Some expression. An expression of extravagance. I'm rich, I can. And we can see it to a certain degree. You know, the king, you know, when he's wearing his robes, you got somebody carrying the robes, dragging on the ground. Because it wasn't specifically pants, it was just garments. Garments dragging on the ground. Right? So, yeah, it was, truly, it was an expression of extravagance. But you know what? If you look back to the 60s, right? Okay, you look back to the 60s, you know, everybody wore their pants above the ankles. You know, that was the norm, to wear your pants above the ankles. You wear white socks and black shoes, you know. So this was the norm. Then, someplace around the middle, the hippie movement started. You know, the hippie was a rebellion against society. We're not going to bathe, we're going to let our hair hang. And that's what Rastafarianism really is, an extension of the hippie movement, you know, amongst black people. Jamaica came back up to us, right? But that was the rebellion against the society. Part of it was, we're going to let our clothes hang down, drag on the ground, you know. This was part of their expression of rebellion. And it was, you know, an expression of anything goes, wastage, and it's a part of it. So it was a culture. That hanging on the ground was an expression, a cultural expression of, you know, free love, free sex, free everything, you know. People should be free to do your own thing, right? It's what it goes, it's your thing, do what you want to do, you know. this was the slogan of those days, right, you know. So what happened then is that the commercial segment of the culture, you know, it was very, you know, very shrewd. It was able to take these expressions and turn it into style. So the style of the 70s was wear your pants hanging, bell bottoms hanging down, you know, it became the style. And we're still in the tail end of it, you know. Just as they took the black power movement, you know, the afro with the afro comb, you know, the afro with red, black and green afros, and you know, red, black and green underwears, and you know, it just was totally co-opted. The same way they commercialized it, they did the same thing with the hippie movement, and you know, this is where we ended up. So what we're wearing now is the tail end of that same culture. And be sure that if next year the culture changes, you know, the fashion changes, spring fashions or fall fashions is now pants above the ankle, then you're going to see everybody got their pants above the ankle. So if we ask the question now, brother, you're wearing it below the ankle because that is in fashion. No, I'm saying, in fact, you know, if you are shy to wear it above the ankle, and you ask the person, why am I shy? He's shy because it is not the fashion. You see, he doesn't want to be out of fashion. You know, people wear pants above the ankles, they call them, you know, flood pants, we call them some parts, right? You know? What do you call them, what?
Gunnin.
Whatever, you know, everybody got a name for it, okay? But it's ridicule. That's what it means, ridicule.
But the point is that, in other words, you see, the sunnah, the way of the kuffar, right, is more pleasing to you. You know, you prefer to take that on than the sunnah of the Prophet. And the Prophet Muhammad said, فَمَنْ رَغِبَ عَنْ سُنَّتِي فَلَيْسَ مِنِّي. Whoever prefers a sunnah, a way, a style other than mine, is not a true follower of me. You know, that's the bottom line. We come back to, you know.
I'm not defending myself, right? But, you know, they don't have my name, all right?
All right.
I listened to a tape at least last year, and it was kind of helpful for me. Basically, it was teaching me a lot of me, you know, was staring at women because that was a problem I had in this society. I say it to do it often, but sometimes it still don't help. Is there something else? I you got people who call me by my nickname, and I turn, you know, and when they call, I just turn, and the person who called it, you know, ain't wearing nothing Islamic, you know, but I mean, I hear one brother say, the place that came in around, you know, would be 3 o'clock, so then my head would be locked.
Well, I think the bottom line, right, is that one has to, in these type of circumstances, these kind of environments, you know, when one finds oneself in a situation like that, I mean, these are indications that it's very important that the individual get married. You know, this is expression of it. I mean, this is a need that's being expressed. I mean, you have to look back to the origin. So, I mean, it means that you need to be looking seriously about getting married. You know, because this is why Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam had instructed, you know, the males who are out in the society. But, you know, whilst you're out in the society, you see somebody, you know, it catches your attention, whatever, then you go back home to your wife because she has what she has, you know, in the bottom line, you know. So when you don't have anybody to go home to, you have a problem, right? It's exaggerated and increased. So it means these are the signs telling you that, you know, you need to do that, you know, more. I mean, if you are trying, you're using the different prayers that the Prophet has advised, you know, you're fasting and these other things, then, I mean, this is clear signs for you.
Yes, I just want to get one question before we get on here. I want to go back to the dress too, because, you know, a lot of brothers kind of take it as a lack of days, those kind of things. The sisters have to wear their dress. They have to do that. Alright, so, no, it's not proper for the brothers to take this as an easy thing. You know, your brothers go into work wearing coat and towel or pants and shirt and tie, right? How serious is that? As far as some of the days you just read, you know, it's just how serious is it?
Well, in terms of the culture, again, we have a general recommendation of the Prophet Muhammad, may God peace and blessings be upon him, in which he said that man tashabbaha biqawmin fahuwa minhum. One who imitates the way, the culture of a people, is of them. So, from that, you know, scholars have always taught that it is necessary for Muslim males and females in the society to distinguish themselves from the disbelievers. And if you note, when Allah speaks of the female dress, that
you know, she should wear the outer garments. You know, yudnina alayhinna min jalabibihinna. Allah goes on to say, why? لِيُعْرَفْنَا فَلَا يُعْذَيْنِ, that they be known and not be harmed. You see? So some people think, well, they're wearing it to so that they won't be known. No! That they be known in the society and not harmed. So the dress, the female dress, Islamic dress, is to distinguish themselves from the others. So they be known in the society. They know Muslim women are not involved in these other kind of practices. You know, they should be left alone. You know, the same way that the society may respond to the nuns. When they see nuns wearing the full habit, etc., you know, they know this is a person dedicated to God. And, you know, Muslim women, you know, are of a similar nature. Okay? Similarly, the men should distinguish themselves in the dress. And that distinction should be in some aspect of the dress. It doesn't have to be, as our brother said, it isn't necessary for Muslims to take on the cultural dress of another society. You know, whether it be from some part of Africa or Asia or, you know, the Arabian Peninsula or whatever. This is not a requirement. But that whatever they are wearing, it should be modified to comply with the Islamic principles of dress. Part of that is, in terms of dress for the Muslim, I mean, they usually included in dress is the growing of the beard. Growing of the beard, trimming the mustache is part of the dress of the belief, of the believing male. It's part of the requirement. And, you know, wearing some other symbol, you know, which will help to distinguish that person, you know, whether it be something on their head, you know, or a particular type of shirt or whatever, you know, should also be there to further distinguish themselves, you know. But if a person decided they're going to wear, for example, a tie, now the tie is a part of the Western culture, but I know some brothers say, well, the tie is a symbol of the cross. Well, we have to bring, before we can make a statement like that, one really has to bring evidence for it. I mean, evidence, documented evidence for it, you know. And as far as I've seen, there isn't any. I mean, this thing has evolved from something which they used to tie up the upper part of the shirt, close this upper part, and it evolved into loops and eventually it took this form. It wasn't a part of religious symbols. So if a person chooses to wear that, I mean, we cannot say, brother, you know, you're not, you're against Islamic culture, you're not in the Sunnah, whatever, you know, we can't run that. But if he's wearing, you know, if he wears a jacket, then the jacket should come and cover his hair if he's wearing a jacket and pants, you know, or his shirt, you know, should be either out, loose, coming down, covering this area. So there should be sufficient modification in that dress that he complies with Islamic principle. And we say additionally it would be preferable if he also added some other item of distinction, which may be something on his head, you know, or something of that nature.
Brother Gulam, can you give us some comment on Muslim men wearing earrings? I've seen that, you know. And also, the women seem to be as fashionable that even though they are fully quinoa down, that their earrings should be exposed.
Well, in the case of Muslim men wearing earrings, right, or bracelets, or, you know, necklaces, right, this, as a norm, is considered a part of female dress, as a norm. Now, there are some cultures in certain parts of Africa where the wearing of these things are done by both males and females. So in those areas, if you are there and you wear it, it's not a problem. But where it is in a society that is a norm for women to wear this particular type of ornamentation, whatever, for men to take it on then becomes an imitation or of female style. And the Prophet, you know, had said that, you know, that Allah's curse was on the males who imitated the dress of the females and the females who imitated the dress of the males. And we know that those people who are in control of the fashion industry are for the main part homosexuals. You know, the leading fashion figures are homosexuals. This is real. And they have, from the times past, from in the 60s onwards, they have been in the process of modifying dress till they reach what they call the unisex. I mean, either you're a male or a female, they both can wear it, no difference between the two. You know, so they have been trying to blur the lines between what is male and what is female. You know, so that men are now spending, you know, hours in the hairdresser getting their hair done. You know, this thing was just normal. You know, it was women who did this. You know, they're wearing, you know, flowery things, clothes, looking very effeminate. You know, and the women now they're wearing suits. The women are wearing suits and, you know, brogues and, you know, ties and the whole thing. Yes, is part of the being promoted. And this is the goal. The goal is that crossover. You know, right now we can laugh at, you know, Dennis Rodman, the basketball player, the orange hair. You know, last interview he had, he came wearing a woman's dress, right? And we can laugh, you know, about it. But the way things are headed, I mean, don't be surprised if that becomes, you know, the fashion. Or in terms of the so the earrings, which is normally associated with women, for men to be wearing them again, this is not acceptable Islamically. It is imitating women. And for women, the hair, the covering of the hair includes the ears. As the Prophet ﷺ said, the ears are from the head. The ears are from the head. So this is why in making wudu, ablution, the head is wiped and the ear follows without having to renew the water because it's all part of one process. So the ear should be covered, and along with that, the ornamentation of the ear.
But the men wear the earrings.
I said.
No. But I would like to know, you say you're talking about the Greeks and the cultures and all that. I would like to know that if the Greeks have a philosophy of their own, if the word Greek that went into Alexandria and how destroyed the library and how taken the books or whatever, how went into research of those books and how taking others' philosophy and have gathered all different philosophies and put it into your system and made something out of it and said that this is their philosophy.
So what's your question, brother?
I would like to know if the Greeks did conquer the library in Alexandria. It was them that went in there and got the different philosophies.
Well, it really is irrelevant whether the Greeks absorbed philosophies from other societies that predated theirs or not, you know, from Egypt, etc. Because in the end, that culture was a pagan culture. The cultures of Egypt, you know, the Egyptian culture was fundamentally a pagan culture. You know, same thing with, in our desire to try to find our roots and that, you know, people have gone into, you know, Africa and, you know, trying to take on certain African Ashanti and, but much of that culture was pagan culture. You know, what was Islamic? What where Islam had influenced these areas, we can recognize and feel proud about as Muslims. But what was not, what was from pagan culture, and there's no pride in that, you know, no pride in paganism. As a Muslim society, we shouldn't have, you know, museums of antiquities where we save the idols of the people of the past. Idols are to be destroyed.
I'm looking at this big in quantum.
Muslims participating in Kwanzaa. Kwanzaa is the East African harvest celebration, right? It's haram. It would be considered haram. I mean, this is a part of that cultural expression, that pagan culture's expression.
I want to go back to the bracelet you mentioned. In some parts of Africa, you go and this is a normal thing, you know, then it's no problem. But how does that tie with Islam? Is this now becomes a part of that African culture, or do it have any basis in Islam? You know, back to the Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, the tabi'in, the bracelet part of it.
Well, the wearing of a bracelet, remember we talked about the principle of distinguishing or determining which things are permissible and which are not. We go back to that basic division of all things into either ibadah, things which are fundamentally acts of worship, and mu'amalat, things which are fundamentally social, custom, you know, cultural, socio-economic interactions, right? That the rule for the social customs, etc., is that the mu'amalat is that they're all halal except those that were specifically forbidden. And the rules for the ibadat is the opposite, the acts of worship, that they're all forbidden except those that were specifically permitted. So when we look at the issue of wearing a bracelet, one has to look, was the bracelet specifically prohibited? No. What was specifically prohibited was males imitating the customary practices of the female. So if in this society it is the customary practice of females to wear bracelets, then for males to wear them also is imitation of their practice. If in another society, because for example, like a skirt, right? For a man to go and put on a skirt here, and walk in the street, I mean, he would be obviously, you know, some kind of cross-dressing, transsexual type individual, right? You know, he would be classified as such, imitating the dress of the female. But if he went to Scotland, the people are wearing skirts, kilts, right? It's a norm in their society, right? So that is not considered, that particular dress is not considered a female dress. Males are wearing it. And it doesn't go against the principles of Islamic covering for males, because it does cover between the navel and the knee. So it is to a certain degree, what may be determined as un-Islamic because of imitation of either the disbelieving religious practices or the imitation of the dress of women, this may vary from area to area. This may vary. This involves a certain amount of fiqh here, and the person has to look into the culture, look at the practices before identifying it. But it's very clear. For the people of that area, those people who are imitating women's dresses, clear. They stand out. It's in cultures now where they have brought about that change in such a gradual fashion that you don't even realize it's happening to you. You see, in our culture, this is what has happened. In those cultures, you know, the person making those changes is very obvious, very clear. But in this culture, where that process of, you know, feminizing male dress and masculinizing, you know, female dress, I mean, this has been a very gradual process to the point where people are no longer, you know, questioning, is this permissible? What is going on here? You know, homosexuals have reached that point where they have that kind of effect on the society. Nobody dares to question even their own practices. What is the position of Islamic law against women having nose rings? Well, the nose rings were worn in the time of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and it wasn't forbidden specifically. So some scholars who hold that this is a part of their ornamentation which should be covered, would say that woman should cover her face wearing a niqab also. Others who hold that it is a part of ornamentation which will show naturally without her desiring to expose her ornamentation would say it's permissible for her to wear the nose ring without covering her face.
Use the voice.
No, you right now.
Age before beauty.